April 15th. It's public hearing on House Bill 5031, Insurance Pool Governing Board. We're continuing our agency presentation. And just a couple of housekeeping items. If there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please turn it off so that it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And also we have Rosie and Rosette, who is here and is with us. They love to collect dollars.
Your Rosie.
And coins. And at the end of the session, these funds will go to the Oregon Food Bank. The purpose of it, the collection, is to discourage the use of acronyms. Often in this building, we talk to ourselves through alphabet soup. And so Rosie says that if you do that, then you pay up, and she will make sure that those dollars at the end of session goes to the food bank. With that, we'll continue where we were. And I'd like to make a couple announcements. Both sessions this afternoon got through very late. As a result, members will probably be straggling in as they try to grab lunch to on a quick run, and we'll be here. Also, we will take a brief recess at about 1:25 because some of us are involved in a press conference at 1:30, and then we will return. So with those housekeeping items out of the way, welcome, Mr. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And the first thing I want to draw attention to and maybe go over with you, Madam Chair, is some information that you requested at the yesterday's hearing that I believe we have passed some information out to you. You specifically asked for some information on the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program termination, and we've compiled that for the biennium. And if you have that in front of you, I'll go a little bit through that with you. What we've listed here is the disenrollment reasons that we have coded into the database system. And ineligible at redetermination, I think, is an obvious one. That generally is because people have increased their income during that 12-month period and are no longer eligible. Carrier termination generally refers to when a client can actually call an insurance carrier and cancel the policy rather than call us. And when they do that, we will follow the carrier's instructions to stop subsidy payments. Cancellation by members is when they notify us. We do not necessarily write down the reason, and certainly we do not put it in the database, but they may just call us up and say, I no longer want the subsidy from you. We do have people that die each year, and these are primarily come from the OMIP side, which is usually those with more chronic health conditions. Some become eligible for Medicare. About 25% of the people terminate from the program just by stopping the payment of premiums. What happens to those, we're not sure. Unable to verify employment, that really means generally that either the group has dropped their coverage or they have left employment with that particular employer. And so they do not provide us then with any further wage statement showing any additional deductions. Covered by OHP or the Oregon Health Plan means that people have actually probably gone down in income and have moved over to the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid program. Found ineligible at audit. We have auditing staff who, on a random basis as well as a targeted basis, I mean by targeted, if something appears to be amiss, they can be assigned to an auditor, and then on an auditing basis, they select a certain number of applications and redeterminations, and if we find that that person was eligible, then they are asked to leave the program, and if any funds are owed by those individuals, then we attempt to recover those. In some cases, we'll have to go to the Department of Revenue or the Attorney General's office if there's fraud involved to assist us. But that gives you kind of a breakdown of the reasons for terminations. we probably collect a little bit more data than the private sector. The private sector, it's almost always non-payment of premium. Most people cancel insurance policies, whether it's auto policy, life policy, or health insurance policies, just simply by not paying premiums. And there is no written communication to us. And although we do allow a 30-day reinstatement, these are folks that chose not to reinstate. Madam Chair, I don't know if you had any questions on that. I believe also Senator Gordley asked for some information about numbers of enrolled in our program, not just against the population of the state in the eight or nine regions, but also against the percentage of states uninsured. And this is just a look at the current enrollment. It doesn't really track the 13 or 14,000 lives that have been in the program over the last few years. But it's pretty close to the percentage of states uninsured. I think the Willamette Valley is and the South Coast are those that have higher enrollments than they had if it was totally based on population or the uninsurance portion of the state. But generally, we're within 1 or 2% in all the other regions of the state. So I didn't know if you had any questions on that, and I can meet with Senator Gordley at another time to go over those in more detail with her. I would like to turn to page 32, Madam Chair, and talk a little bit about the marketing information and outreach program of the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And there is one piece of legislation, I think, that I need to spend a little time on that could impact what we do. But just briefly, in 1987, when they established the Insurance Pool Governing Board, it was charged with assisting businesses that had previously been uninsured to purchase insurance for the owners, the employees, and the dependents. And we actually had a certified plan function that from 1987 to the year 2000, where we enrolled over 20,000 employers, about 60,000 employees and dependents. But because of the market reforms of the mid-1990s, we saw really the program start to trend down a little bit in 1996 and 97 after we had about 32,000 at one time enrolled, as we had access to group coverage on a guaranteed issue basis. And so there really wasn't a need. The premiums were pretty steady. The economy was going well. Employers were providing coverage. And a decision was made in conjunction with the IPGB board, the Insurance Pool Governing Board board. I'm going to have to pay $5 to Rosie or Rosetta at some point here.
Both Rosie and Rosette appreciate that.
I will. And I did
we don't care whether you put it in the blue one or the pink one. Just put it in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say when you first talked about Rosie and Rosette up front, I didn't know if you were talking about George and me, but that was okay. So in 1999, we had a piece of legislation that phased out the certified plan portion of the Insurance Pool Governing Board plans. And we really concentrated our efforts around agent referrals to both businesses, for businesses and individuals who were looking for health insurance, and in stakeholder and insurance industry training activities, and really ramped those up in conjunction with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. However, in the year 2001, we had a bill passed, House Bill 3126, sponsored by Representative Nolan, that asked the Insurance Pool Governing Board to get back into the certified plan business. Groups had started dropping coverage, or at least reducing the level of benefits and premium contributions for primarily dependents. The number of uninsured businesses has started to rise because of very significant premium increases of 20 to 40% for a 2 or 3 year period. So they passed the bill, and it was signed by the governor. However, there was one component of the bill that really has prevented us from moving forward with its implementation, and it is a requirement that whatever certified plans that we put into place and make available to small businesses also meet the benchmark benefit plan of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The problem with that is the benchmark benefit plan has to represent what is already commonly offered in the market. So you have one bill that says we want a low-cost plan not subject to mandates that uninsured businesses can use as kind of an entree, and another piece of the statute that says, well, that may be, but it has to be at a high benefit level that it meets the benchmark. The upshot is that it was a contradiction in the statutes, and working with the governor's office and Representative Nolan, we let them know that we could not move forward with the bill's implementation unless there were some changes to the statutes. A bill has been introduced by Representative Mary Nolan and Representative Krummel, and I believe it's House Bill 3439, that breaks the linkage between the Insurance Pool Governing Board benchmark benefit plan and the Insurance Pool Governing Board certified plan, so that the board would have the ability, if that was to pass, to offer plans that were not necessarily subject to mandates, that could be a little bit more innovative in terms of their benefit structure and design. So we are kind of standing back and waiting to see what happens with that bill. It is currently in Representative Cruz's committee on the House side, but has not received a hearing at this point. One was scheduled, but then postponed, I think, until this week or next week. The Insurance Pool Governing Board, then, in terms of some of our successes over the last few years, we've enrolled since 1997 over 13,000 individuals into Family Health Insurance Assistance Programs, where they've received a subsidy to purchase health insurance. And these, again, are people who have been uninsured for the previous 6 months, so they are uninsured folks. But I think the key thing is we took what has been traditionally since 1997 a state-funded program, the subsidy program, both in 97 and 99 and most of 2001, and through the waiver process that was contained in House Bill 2519, we have had the ability to begin leveraging those state dollars so that we could use federal funds to really expand the number of people we serve without any additional state fund dollars. An example of that is that we currently have about $19 million now for the FEOP program, and we're able to serve about 4,000 to 4,500 individuals with that prior to the waiver. With the waiver, we're able to expand that to about 15,000 folks without any additional state funds. And that, we believe, is the real move of FEOP is two things. One, utilizing those federal dollars, and it's a 72%, 28% match rate in most of the enrollment, and a partial is 60% federal, 40% state, and the other. That really leverages the state dollars. So when you talk about someone, for example, in group coverage, where the average premium is $80, you're talking about a $20 to $25 contribution level on the part of a state to enroll that person in coverage, the rest coming from federal funds. The second is under the waiver, is really the focus on group coverage. In 2001, there was a lot of debate during that session around House Bill 25-9 as to what the emphasis of the Insurance Pool Governing Board subsidy program should be. And it really began to move in terms of people towards the group side. There was a strong desire on the part of the legislature and the emergency boards that met and the waiver application steering committee to expand group far beyond what I think any of us originally intended or at least planned on. Initially, we were going to look at expanding group coverage to about 19,000. In the governor's balanced budget, that's been pulled back to about 11,000. But that's where you get a really good bang for your dollar in terms of the state dollar. Number two, given what's going on in today's economy, given what's going on in small businesses and the difficulty they have in maintaining coverages and contributions for dependent coverage, given that the uninsurance rate is rising, that seemed to be a logical thing for the legislature and working with the governor to do, and the federal government has agreed to it. We are the first state out of the box on this private sector approach. Other states are attempting to follow us through federal waivers, but no one has, I think, the infrastructure or the model that we have in place, which was one of the difficulties we had, because when you asked us really to put this program together in 1997, there was no other state to go to see how they did it, how they worked with carriers, how they worked with small businesses, what kind of payment mechanisms did you want to set up. And it was really a great challenge, and we think we've put together a tremendous infrastructure that, whether it's 20,000 people or 10,000 or 50,000, that works very efficiently in working with the different stakeholder groups. The other agency successes, again, we've tried to make sure that we had regional geographic representation. We wanted to make sure there was consumer choice. One of the principles that the legislature decided very early on was whatever group plan is out there, we wanted to make sure that we gave people the choice of enrolling with that employer and not just to shove them into a specific benefit plan. Did we want to continue or take... Okay. Because I know they have a news conference that some of you are going to. We assume the day-to-day administrative responsibility for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program in the year 2000. Initially, when we established this program, we were going to contract out with a third-party administrator to perform those functions. Because of the nature of some of the decisions around the budget and the populations, there was no predictability really in terms of any revenue stream for the third-party administrator, and they lost a considerable amount of money because we initially thought they were going to serve 15,000. That was dropped to 5,000, later to about 4,500. So within about a 3 or 4 month period of time, we worked with the third-party administrator and brought those administrative functions around eligibility and payments of subsidies in-house, and that seems to have worked out well, although there is a House bill now before the legislature that would allow us perhaps to go outsource portions of that once we get a stable population and a program, so we can go to the private sector and say, here it is what we want you to do, and it's going to last for a little while. You can step in and take the chance and make a reasonable bid. So we're hoping to have a little bit more flexibility, whether that's eligibility, premium collection, or whether we keep that inside and outsource some of the marketing and community stakeholder training sessions. We're not sure yet, but we think we've done a good job inside so far. Some of the performance measures, a number of referrals through, and I'm on page 35, through the agent referral program, and this is for small businesses. In the year 2001, we made 883, 1,315 in 2002. 2003, our initial that was done 4 or 5 months ago was that we would do about 800. Part of that was because we knew we were going to be focusing on the FEOP and some of the marketing that we did there. And then it moves up to about 2,500 by the year 2005. You'd understand there's about 14,000 businesses that generally open up in this state every year. Now, some of those are one-person self-employed shops. Some of those are a new restaurant. So it's a difficult task getting out there and trying to contact those. We do send out about 2,500 pieces of information around small employer health insurance options each month through the Oregon Business Center for businesses who or individuals who inquire about starting a business. But what happens is somebody calls us up and says, I want to buy health insurance, or I'm having problems with my health insurance. How can you help? And if they're from Bend, we've got a list of agents in Bend that we feel comfortable that have been trained in all the different state programs, insurance regulations, and have volunteered to work with us. We have a variety of different speaking, Spanish-speaking, Russian-speaking, Korean, Chinese agents also, and especially in the metropolitan area. So if it's a business where the owner is Russian, we have an agent who is fluent in Russian to go to assist them. I should tell you that this does not include about 4,500 or 4,600 referrals we made to individuals. These are primarily businesses. Through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we had an additional 4,000 or 4,500 to 5,000 referrals we made. And this is where an individual calls up and says, thank you for the subsidy, but now what do I do? And if they live in, Coos Bay, we've got a list of two or three agents down there, and we give them their agent's name, or in some cases we ask for permission to give the name of the individual to the agent who will contact them. So the agent referral program has really been a core thing for being able to have people contact us and for us to then push them back into the communities with the experts in their communities. Health insurance is a funny thing. It's still primarily face-to-face to someone you know or someone in your local community. It isn't calling New York City and buying a health plan. We find that if you live in, Coos Bay, or if you live in Astoria, or live in Salem, dealing with somebody in your local community really makes a difference in whether you end up with that health plan and having your people covered or not. Training sessions, we go out and primarily agents and also stakeholders, and that may be Head Start programs, community action agencies, a variety of different social service agencies, but we do formal training. Now, this doesn't include some of the smaller meetings we have, but this is where we really advertise and bring people in. In 2002, we did 57 of those. In 2003, we envision that we'll do 45 formal training sessions. The number of agents and community partners trained during that time, 1,500 last year, and we project 1,000 for the next three years. And you can't look at divide the number of sessions into the people, because some years you're in Hermiston where you get 5 people, and some years you're in Portland where you get 100 people. And we try to mix it up and go out to the east and south and the coast, and sometimes, and the other times we concentrate on the valley for that. Number of Oregonians enrolled in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. These are the number of people at one time during the year that would be enrolled. I think the 7,500 for 2003 is what our objective is. And by the end of 2004, we want about 15,000. The 25,000 listed there was prior to the governor's balanced budget, reducing us from the 25,000 level to the 15,000 enrollment. One of this,
Mr. Chair, Rocky, could I clarify that?
Mm-hmm.
So the 25,000 under the year 2005 is what?
My sense is that's going to be probably in the 15,000 to 17,000.
I have a question, too.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. In the increased percentage of eligible FEOC member who enrolled from the year 2000 to 2003, you jumped from 48% to 70%.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the 70% is first of all, it's an objective. It is not the actual, because we're just in the first 3 months. But one of the things that we find is people become eligible for the subsidy program. We provide them, as I told you yesterday, with a certificate of eligibility that they can go out and shop, and maybe they get an agent referral fee. But we find that only half of those individuals actually end up enrolling in a health benefit plan. One of the internal objectives that we've established is to increase that significantly by at least 50%, going from about a 50% to 70 or 75% over the next biennium, over the next 3 years. Now, we're doing that a variety of ways. First of all, personal calls and hand-holding people, trying to help them navigate the health insurance market. And if you look at this population, generally been uninsured for at least a six-month period. A large percentage of those have been chronically uninsured. That is that their incomes have been below 200% of poverty for a long time. So they haven't had the experience of making the applications to the individual market or working with their employers to get coverage. So we're really trying to figure out how the best way, because we don't have offices throughout the state. We just have our phone lines and an agent referral system to work with these people to really help them navigate this process.
So what follow-up Mr. Chair. So what is happening out there in the marketplace or the economy or whatever to make you think that we will go from 48% eligibility to 70%? I guess that's what I mean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we're not sure it's the economy as much as it is sometimes just helping people and teaching them how to navigate, make application,
so it's
how to fill out the applications.
It's an outreach.
It's an outreach.
Thank you.
Now, we know that there are some individuals who end up not enrolling for economic reasons. Their income went down and they moved to the Oregon Health Plan as opposed to the private sector. Or some of them get jobs where the coverage is provided by the employer and paid for in full, so they don't need the subsidy. Others go out there and say, you know, it's great you're paying the subsidy, but I can't afford the deductibles, copays. And so they make a decision once they look at the market that it isn't meaningful to them. And one of the things that we'll be doing is gathering a lot more statistics in this, because we've targeted it specifically as a performance measure that we've not had really any meaningful effort to address before. The last performance measure that we're looking at is reducing the administrative cost. As a administrator of an agency, I will tell you that at the enrollment levels and the funding levels that we've had, to maintain that fixed cost with low enrollments just didn't make a lot of sense to anybody, whether it was us, whether it was to the budget management division of DAS, or to the legislature. And by expanding, going from that 4,000, 5,000 folks up to the 15,000 level, that will allow us, we believe, to finally bring the administrative costs into line with what I think is reasonable. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool, my state and third-party administrative cost has been under 7% for 9,000 enrollments for the past 12 years. My objective is to match one of the other programs that we manage, which is the high-risk pool, to try to get that down to a reasonable level. And it always is going to be a little more because you have an eligibility process and a payment process in the group market than you would have with some of the other programs that we manage, but it ought not be at the levels of 14 to 15%. That's too many dollars going to administration and not to programs. So that we think will be a very important piece for us coming up. One of the benchmarks or performance measures that we have not included and we're working on is customer satisfaction surveys. Let me tell you what we're doing in one program, and because that translates what we want to do in this program. With a high-risk pool, we actually do three customer service surveys. The first is when somebody enrolls, we send them out a survey that says, how was the process? What were the problems? How could we have done better? Then after about 6 months into the program, or annually thereafter, we survey them, and this is just starting in the last year, and the question is, you're in our program, what do you think? What kind of changes? And then we're going to have a termination survey. So we want to get them at the beginning, while they're in the program, and when they leave the program, with a little bit different kinds of questions, but generally figuring out, based on what point they're at, how we could have communicated and worked and provided service to them better. We're working with the Office of Health Policy and Research and the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative Group to really figure out how we want to do that survey. Now, we've done them in the past. We've gone out and we looked at both people that were on the reservation list, and we also surveyed people that were enrolled in the program. But it was really a one-time measure to look at what they felt about the program, their health, what it meant to them. We wanted a little bit more automated so you can track over a period of time changes in how people view the program and what issues they raise. So we hope to implement that during the next benchmark or the next biennium. On page 36, finally, the one benchmark that we've been tied to from day one is benchmark number 54, which is really the percentage of Oregonians without health insurance. We impact it in a small way, but we impact it. One of the hard things that we always have to deal with is from a macro level, we look at 18% down to 11% up to 14%. And these programs that are out there don't seem to be controlling that going up over the last few years. And that's really recognition. The economy has more of an impact than the subsidy program. The economy has more of an impact sometimes than guaranteed issue and guaranteed access to coverage. But it is one that we continue to focus on and we think is the bellwether benchmark for the state in terms of ensuring the health of their citizens. And remember, the real issue here is not so much insurance, it's health. And one has just made a correlation that with health insurance, you do have access to primary care physicians as well as specialists that will ultimately lead to better health. On page 37, we've laid out the administrative and program costs historically. That's where some of the figures come from. There is an error on page 37 I just want to point out, and it's in the bottom box, 1997-99 actuals for total cost marketing, where it says 5.58%. That actually should say 100%. That 5.58 is of the total budget, not of just the marketing. All of our marketing we consider to be administrative costs, even though they're agent training, agent referral, publications. It is not going in terms of dollars into the hands of a client, so we view that as very different than a program dollar cost. On page 38 is the governor's balanced budget. And again, I want to point out that, first of all, we're currently funded through tobacco settlement funds. In the first biennium, it was tobacco tax, then tobacco settlement. And this is the first biennium that we are moved to really general fund appropriation for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, as well as the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And you see a big shift also in terms of other funds, and that is because of the waiver of obtaining federal funds to match the state fund contributions. So $20 million was kind of around the base budget. It's now being requested at 59, but $38 million of that basically is new money to the state, federal funds, through the waiver that we received from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services under House Bill 2519. I'm not sure how much detail you would...
Rocky, were you intentionally not using acronyms so you wouldn't have to make Rosie feel good today?
Madam, Ms. Chair, Senator Gordley, what I actually did is offer $5 to the pot when I began, and today I'm doing better. And that
you're doing a great job because I've been trying to catch you guys.
Senator Gordley,
thank you.
May I introduce...
Excuse me. Senator Carter, I'm sorry.
I know Rocky know me, but I hadn't noticed that. I was up there. I sat in the wrong seat.
Sitting next to Senator Carter for evening after evening after evening, that was...
That's right. No, other no problem. Groups. But I did want to ask you, and I think I was on the end of it, our colleague from the House had asked you about with economic conditions being what they are today, and so many layoffs, and how is it disproportionately affecting small businesses and their ability to pay for those people that are left? Because I don't see you with a critical mass, which makes your overhead pretty high as I look at how the numbers are skewed across the state. And then with them having to do some layoffs, how is it affecting their ability to pay?
Yeah, Senator, or Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we've seen probably in the small group market about 20,000 Oregonians lose coverage in the last year. Now that I don't know if that's because of unemployment or if that's because businesses are actually dropping coverage or in some cases we know that it's also where they're raising the share of premiums that employees have to pay, primarily for dependent coverage. So we don't know if people are dropping out of that. The primary focus during the emergency boards of in November and September was really to try to see if we could help prop that up by providing some subsidies to the lowest income levels in those businesses that were probably the most adversely affected. And that's the critical mass that we're trying to get to, which affects a couple of things. One, hopefully business is able to maintain insurance. Because remember, a business has to have a participation level in order to maintain coverage. So if you've got 20 employees, you can't have 10 that say, no, I can't afford it, I want out. So it's very important to try to, for those who can least afford it, make sure that they can stay in the coverage, because that helps the employer as a whole. We have just great examples. An agent in Florence in last month wrote 5 new businesses that previously were uninsured. And they're very small employers, a tavern, a sanitation company, a nursery, and I'm forgetting the other one. But they had anywhere from 6 to 18 employees. 4 to 5 of those, and in one instance it was 3, are very low income. They couldn't afford their share of the premiums for the dependent coverage. And by getting family health insurance subsidy in there, they were able then to provide dependent coverage for all their employees. If they didn't, they would have met the participation requirement, which is generally 50% of employees have to enroll in dependent coverage for them to offer it. So that's the piece that we think is just really critical. And these are all, you know, minimum wage or $7, $8 an hour employees that are looking at anywhere from $400 to $600 a month for health insurance. The employer's usually picking up all the cost of the employee, which may be $250 to $300, but needs help in that other $300 for the low-wage folks. I don't know if that answers your question, Senator Carr.
I know, you know, as we have sat to look at the whole Oregon Health Plan, are there some things that would be considered non-basic health care that is associated with your plan, or is it bare bones?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, what we're required by statute is basically the most common plans offered in the group market. So, and the most common plans right now run between $500 and $1,000 deductible plans. 5 years ago, you know, the best way to explain this is 1989, when the Insurable Governing Board had certified plans. We had a plan by statute that we had to offer for $53 a month per enrollee. And we could buy a $200 or $250 deductible plan for $53. When we got out in the year 2000, that same $53 purchased a $2,500 deductible plan. So what we've seen is a large part of the group market basically move up from a $200 or $300 to a $500 deductible plan, and now you're starting to see more and more $750 deductible plans. Now, the problem that they're going to run into is there's going to be a point where it's meaningless. Going to somebody who makes $6 an hour or $1,000 a month and saying, we now have a $1,000 deductible plan, do you not feel good? Their response is, no, I don't. So there's going to be a point where, although there will be catastrophic coverage out there, you're going to get some pushback, I think, on the deductibles, and you're starting to see that a little bit now. But the other side of that is the small business person has been faced with increases of 20 to 30% 3 years in a row. I mean, it's been really tough, and that relates not just to medical inflation, which is, how much a little piece of or a bottle of aspirin cost. It also relates to utilization, and that is you don't go get that aspirin until you get an MRI. Remember, in medical costs, when people are saying they're going up 20 or 30%, when inflation's only going up, 2 or 3%, why? It's because that medical inflation includes utilization. And utilization is tests. It's new technology. It's not that the bottle of aspirin costs more. That's inflation, and that's there too. It's that we don't use the aspirin now. We use a $30, you know, a pill substitute for the aspirin, and that's really what the utilization is. In the individual market, you'll see that if you look at the statistics in 1997 when we first started FEOP, the average individual plan purchased was a $200 deductible plan. I'm talking about indemnity. You still have the managed care plans, Kaiser, HMO Oregon, and some of those that still had just co-pays without deductibles. The average deductible now, most carriers don't offer $200 deductible plans, or if they do, they're too expensive for the normal individual to purchase. I mean normal in the way of generally income, middle America. So for someone with less funds available, they were completely frozen out of that market. The average deductible plan now in the indemnity market, Blue Cross, ODS, is $500 a month. And for some carriers, it's as high as 1,000. So that's in the individual market. So both the group and the individual, you see a big shift from the employer paying or the insurance company paying to really putting it back into the pocket of those individuals that purchase the plans.
Senator Morris.
Rocky, did I hear you say $500 deductible per month?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you know, I said that yesterday, too, and I was corrected by my staff. It's $500 deductible per year. I apologize. That's an annual deductible. We would take on any carrier that put out a $500 per month deductible, but that's per year. I apologize.
Rocky, going back to utilization, is part of the some of the testing that's taking place in to make sure that you're not getting into some malpractice issues, because it appears as though utilization is really up as far as certain testing.
Madam Chair, I mean, I'm not an expert in that area, but I think anecdotally everyone, you know, that's what we read, that part of that utilization increase, especially in the testing, relates to the malpractice tort issues. There is a hospital, I think, that if you go in, and it's actually in Southwest Washington, and I'd rather not give the name publicly. I'm not even sure I remember it now, but that if you go in and tell them that you have a headache, you get an MRI before somebody asks you if you had migraines. If you have migraines, then there's medications, and you have a history, and they're able to do that. But they're so concerned about their exposure that they'll have you have an MRI before they'll take the history to find out whether it's just a migraine issue and related to medication. So we know that those kinds of things exist. The other piece is, and we might as well face it, we all demand more. We just demand more. There's not many of you that are in the audience or up front that are as old as me, but when I used to fall down, the mother put Curicomb on the knee, and now when my kid falls down, it costs $1,100 to have the MRI, and it's the same injury and the same thing. Now, I will tell you, our knees are in better shape than when we used to put the Curicomb on, but there's a cost to that. We're an aging population. We're getting older. We demand more, and I don't see it stopping until we probably run out of money, and that's what's going to bring it to a halt.
Do you have another question, Senator Moore? And that was pretty.
Well, yes, I do.
Yeah.
Rocky, looking at the budget on 38, the current service level projection of $107 million with the FTEs of 46.5 and then substantial reduction in the governor's budget down to $59 million, but we've added 17 FTE now. You may have covered that and I wasn't present. I apologize for that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, this really kind of goes back to the ramp-up that we started doing with the emergency boards, and when the waiver was first submitted, we estimated that we would have about 25,000 enrollments. And when we came before the emergency board, on both occasions, I think there were two emergency boards, we went to a total of approximately 62 staff for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. We also identified at that point an additional, and I don't remember what it was, 30 staff if you used our caseload ratios, how many people can do eligibility and all that. We said there was as many as 25 to 30 additional staff that we thought that we could justify, but that we weren't going to ask for. Because our sense was, from an administrative cost perspective, that it was our responsibility to find out the efficiencies and the innovative ways and the systems to keep from having to hire those folks, finding new ways of doing what we do. So we only asked for 17 of those positions, which would have been equivalent to about a 15 or 16,000 population in this. We're asking for the technical adjustment on the 17 positions, but as of right now, based on what we see, I'm not going to try to hide anything from anybody. We think we are only going to need about 5 of those 17 positions. But we're not sure because we haven't got to that 15,000 level yet. We have filled 5 of those positions of the 17, and we've kept 2 of the original 46 vacant. And we've done that because we thought that some in that 17 were more valuable than some in the 42. And we're trying to keep it as low a level as we can. Madam Chair, with Senator Carter, I just wanted to let you know that we did bring the information that you requested. I'd be happy to meet with you afterwards. I've gone through it on the distribution of uninsured and the FEOP enrollment also. With that, Madam Chair, I'll
leave Mr. Naughton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton with the Budget and Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services. Just before I jump into the presentation that we've done, which I believe Mr. Britton has handed out to you, which you've seen with other folks, again, to highlight what Senator Carter raised about the significance and the critical mass of this program. There's two things that this agency does strategically in the large picture of health care financing from the state of Oregon. The first one is the number of people that they actually serve, which is the 4,000 people that we're going to ramp up to 25 to 30,000 people under the newest Oregon Health Plan waivers, but the governor's budget drops back down to 15 to 17,000. Those are direct people that are being served by this program. The other piece of significance, which Mr. King mentioned a few minutes ago, is their ability to leverage the private employers to stay in the healthcare business. Now, I remind you of that first chart that Mr. King showed you, that pie chart, that showed that 70% of those receiving insurance are receiving it through the private sector. One of the things that we saw through this economic downturn is that we have lost people. We have had more and more people becoming uninsured, even though enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan has been going up all by name long. And the reason is because the private sector has been contracting. One of the strategic places that this subsidy program does is try to help stabilize that private sector so that they can continue to do the place that they've always done, which is providing good benefits for the employees. And before we go into that, that is the strategic question that Mr. Britton raised for you the first day, which is where does this program fit in the larger state budget? So whatever we talk about and what we want you to walk away from this meeting with is for you to decide how this fits in with all the other pieces that are going on. With that overview, Madam Chair, I'll turn or begin with my presentation. And on page 2 of that, you will see the typical chart you've always seen. There's two big things for you to see on that table. The first one is if you drop down to that line that says total funds, you'll see that back through 1999, 2001, all the way through the fifth special session of 2001-03, we've basically been holding this program at about $20 million, the vast majority of that being other funds, which, as Mr. King mentioned, has fluctuated between tobacco tax monies and tobacco settlement monies. And there were two primary changes that occur in the governor's balanced budget. The first one is the addition of Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program dollars, which is why you see the other funds amount jump fairly significantly. The other part is that we have backfilled or replaced all of the tobacco settlement money with general fund. And the reason for that, as Mr. Britton mentioned, is that the tobacco settlement funds are used for other purposes, primarily bond debt payments. And we've replaced the general fund in this program. So those are the two large things that have changed, which are why the numbers on the right-hand side, as far as percentage changes go, look so incredibly dramatic. Again, it's simply replacing the tobacco settlement funds with general fund, and second, adding the federal match onto these programs and leveraging more people into it. Page 3, you will see that 34%, 35% roughly of this budget is general fund. Page 4, just to highlight to you some of the things that have changed during this biennium, and again, the 178% growth in the program total funds is the addition of the Medicaid and other federal match programs. Page 5 is just to highlight to you that of the budget, 99% of it is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The remaining 1%, which is labeled Insurance for Governing Board, is really the marketing program that Mr. King mentioned to you. The other program, the high-risk pool that Mr. King mentioned, is not technically in this budget. So that all the expenditures for that program are within the budget for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So the only ones you're considering for this budget is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program and then the marketing program. On page 6, 86% of the budget goes out as special payments. And you can see the breakdown between personal services and services and supplies. And then on page 7, again, you'll see the legislatively adopted budget started at about $20.5 million total funds, almost all of that being tobacco settlement funds. Madam Chair, I'm going to roll through this piece pretty quickly because the issues are going to jump out at you as we do that. On page 8, you'll see under package 020, the second bullet there under program adjustments is an increase of $81.7 million of total funds. Under the newest Oregon Health Plan waivers that were passed out of this body and approved by the federal government, it anticipated adding about 25,000 people to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. That is later changed or reduced as part of the governor's balanced budget. But what this package shows you is if we added the full amount of people anticipated in those waivers, it would have been even farther or even a larger increase than what's in the governor's balanced budget. The next package I want to highlight for you is package 050 at the bottom of page 8, which is simply fund swapping the tobacco settlement funds for the general fund. Of that $81 million we mentioned above, about $33 million of that is the general fund or tobacco settlement equivalent. So, again, it's just replacing the tobacco settlement with general fund. Package 092 on page 9 is the large change that the governor's balanced budget did. In essence, what we have done is reduce the program to what at the time we considered the federally mandated minimum program under the newest waivers. Since that time, we've done some recalculations with Legislative Fiscal Office. The intention here was to reduce the program to the minimum amount that would still be eligible to receive federal match. So that is what the governor's budget does. The thing we will mention for you is that with the level of changes being anticipated with the Oregon Health Plan, those waivers are at risk. And I would expect that if this body chooses to go forward with a significantly revamped program to continue the match for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we would have to submit, again, new waivers or another set of waivers, which more than likely we're going to have to do with the Oregon Health Plan anyway. Madam Chair, that's the end of my presentation.
Do you have any indication or guesstimate from the federal government as to what level would put us at risk?
Madam Chair, under the, I think Mr. Britton may be able to help me out with this, under the current waivers, we would be able to go down potentially down to the $16 million of state resources range. With all the other changes going on with the Oregon Health Plan, I think all of this becomes in jeopardy, and we'll leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Britt.
Madam Chair and members, one other comment, and that is that it is a five-year maintenance of effort. So if the waiver was to be retained and the Assembly and the Governor wanted to fund it at a lower level for this particular biennium, it would need to be made up in the following 3 years if this waiver is to remain into effect.
That's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Morris.
The budget that was presented showed the 46.5 FTEs.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, what Mr. King was bringing up with about the 17 positions were positions that should have been added to the underlying budget. They were simply missed in the last month of us developing the governor's balanced budget. We agree with Mr. King that those positions should have been added in as part of this budget. It's simply they were dropped. The ball was dropped partway through the process.
Thank you. This concludes our public hearing on House Bill 5031. We will have, and Ms. Brittany will pick up your notebooks so that he can pass out new notebooks before we get into the other end.
Thank you. Can I get this one?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. That's very, very kind of you. Much appreciated.
Does it have a bottom? I can get to it later.
Just have too many pieces to it.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
while we're waiting to get started again, I just saw someone out in the audience that I haven't seen for a very long time.
Robbie?
Yeah.
Mr. Aldridge, would you please stand? Welcome to the our hearings, Mr. Aldridge.
What a delight.
Huh? Why am I doing this to you? Well, you know, there's a... It's nice to be chronologically advantaged, and I'm glad you came to visit on my birthday. Yours was Saturday and mine, you know? Good people were born in April.
Yes. Yes. Wonderful to see it. Just fantastic. We go back to state corrections.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I won't tell you how far
he's doing now. Today.
Hey.
Being good.
I will not tell you how far he is. I'll go back.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want me to tell that, do you, Roby?
What?
We go back to the old war and poverty days.
You got it.
Wonderful.
Lots of years ago. We'll open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means again, and we're going to hear public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. Welcome, Mr. Tate, and welcome back, Mr. Naughton, and Mr. Britton, would you give us an overview?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I've handed out the budget books for the presentation materials for the senior and people with disabilities cluster within the Department of Human Services, and also to augment that, there is a testimony before Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means, Day 1, April 2003, that will be presented by Mr. Taves and some others from the cluster. I will begin with the memorandum that I've also distributed to all of you and begin with the large print. It's the second page of that memorandum.
Mr. Britton, before you go further, I do want to thank you for considering my eyesight. I really do for having large print, large type.
You're welcome, Madam Chair. Seniors and People with Disabilities, its acronym is SPD, and it provides program funding and policy support for long-term care for seniors, persons with physical disabilities, and persons with developmental disabilities. Also, the Older Americans Act funding, federal funds are included within this cluster. There's some direct financial support through the Oregon Supplemental Income Program, which is tied into a federal Supplemental Security Income Program through the Social Security Administration. And finally, there is staff for disability determination services, licensing and monitoring of facilities, and area agencies on aging staff. 88% of the SPD Cluster General Fund is used for the long-term care program. You can see that the total funds for the long-term care program, about $1.8 billion. Older Americans Act total funds $26.2 million in the governor's budget. That is all federal funds. Direct financial assistance, $9.4 million total funds. Program support and administration, $281.9 million. The total cluster budget included within the governor's balanced budget is almost $2.1 billion. Like the health services cluster, special payments comprise a large percentage of the budget, 88%. Personal services, about $185.8 million, about 9%. Services and supplies, $61.9 million, or about 3% of this cluster budget. The next page, again, like the health services cluster, federal funds, in this case, are about 58% of the seniors and people with disabilities, $2.1 billion budget. General fund, about 35%, and other funds, about 7%. The next page lists major federal funds and other funds' revenue sources in this budget. Again, Medicaid, Older Americans Act, food stamp administrative revenue, and finally, some Medicare revenue to support our licensing and monitoring efforts. Other funds, some local match, pass-through dollars, which we like we do in the health services budget. We take those funds, match them with Medicaid, and return those back to the, in this case, area agencies on aging primarily. In-home client contributions. And finally, Medicare upper payment limit general fund return. And that's a mouthful, and someday I'll explain it to you. But suffice it to say, we're taking general fund dollars to make the MUPL payments. The general fund portion of that payment is returned and spent as other funds. And finally, SSI, Supplemental Security Income Recoveries.
You're looking a little perplexed. Senator Morris?
I'll understand it one of these days.
And estate recoveries. Finally, budget drivers for this cluster, population growth, caseloads for seniors and persons with disabilities have over time increased as we see baby boomers aging. We will see this budget in years in the future also increase as well. Provider costs, healthcare, labor shortages, insurance, market dynamics, consumer preferences, and their ability to choose which kind of long-term care setting they would prefer. Federal Medicaid law, this entire cluster is based upon a variety of home and community-based care waivers. And finally, I've mentioned the Staley lawsuit settlement, which relates to services for the developmentally disabled. Going back to the front page of the memo, budget notes from last session, I noted that there were more than 10 budget notes related to programs in the health services cluster. The department will look at them and discuss them as part of the budget presentation. The budget notes concern a wide variety of issues, including an assessment of costs for state-operated group homes for persons with developmental disabilities, a review of administrative costs for programs for persons with developmental disabilities, implementation of a pilot project to assist veterans applying for or already receiving Medicaid long-term care, an evaluation of Oregon Project Independence fees, implementation of a program monitoring system for area agencies on aging and state senior and disabled services division field offices. I note here that the Secretary of State conducted one change of administrator audit for the seniors and people with disabilities cluster since the 2001 session. It contained no significant findings. Also, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services conducted a review of Oregon's home and community-based care waiver for the aged and physical disabled between July and November 2000. CMS found that the state's system of monitoring the health and safety of clients was adequate, but they noted several areas for improvement, including reevaluation of client need, informing clients of their choices and appeal rights, and ensuring providers have valid contracts. And the cluster managers have responded to that, and I'm sure they'd be happy to respond to your questions about that as well. Interim.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yes, Senator Carter.
Okay. John, when they ask the agency about reevaluation of client need, are you saying that the instrument that where application is made and that not enough information was on it? What is the issue here?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I don't know, and we'll have to ask them that.
Okay.
This was just a summation.
Okay. Thanks.
Following the 2001 legislative session, two senior task forces were created, the Governor's Task Force on the Future of Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities and the House Task Force on Seniors and Disabled Services. And both of those reports are here, and if you'd like your own copies, we can get those for you if you would ask. The House Task Force assessed viable options to keep the long-term care system at continuing levels of services while preparing for the aging of the baby boomers. The Governor's Task Force concluded that a cultural shift is necessary to preserve the system. More personal responsibility for healthy outcomes and financial planning to pay for needed services as one ages. And again, I can get those for you if you would like to see them. There are no fee adjustments. As far as significant policy or oversight issues considered by the emergency board or interim committees, most of you know that we went round and round on reductions to this cluster throughout the special sessions and also the departmental rebalance plans. We looked at state-operated group homes for the developmentally disabled, the costs, ability of private providers to care for the most disabled, and we learned about the Fairview closure history. Staley settlement costs and funding, that was also an emergency board item, and also what came through in evaluating that emergency board item was the need for good data and good information systems that are being developed now for the services to developmentally disabled persons program area. Medicaid reimbursement for long-term care providers, particularly reimbursement for nursing facilities and assisted living facilities. And again, the Oregon Project Independence Fee Report and the Veterans Services Pilot Project Report were two other reports that we heard in the Human Services Subcommittee of the Emergency Board.
Relevant issues, trends, or special challenges, long-term care for seniors and persons with physical disabilities. There's the long-term sustainability of the program in light of baby boomer aging. Budget control. Intake and placement into much of the long-term care system is controlled by non-state entities, area agencies on aging. This is a good news and a bad news feature. Intake and placement are done primarily without regard to the budgetary consequences. That has a good side to it, and it has a not-so-good side to it. With respect to services for developmentally disabled persons, the Staley settlement costs are an area of concern, especially in light of budget reductions. Management information and reporting of data, and as I said a moment ago, new client data and payment system is being developed. And with that, I will turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Britton. Are there any questions? Senator Morris.
Could you elaborate a little more on the good news, bad news, and the intake and placement without regard to financial consequences?
And Madam Chair and Senator
Morris. Graphics have been looked at in terms of how that demand is going to increase.
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I don't have graphics to provide to you, but I would say this, that I believe it was during the 99-01 interim, we had a legislative fiscal and a joint legislative audit committee audit of the area agencies on aging. And one of the observations of that audit was that this is a good system and it provides good benefits as far as people who need the assistance. And that is, they are declared eligible, and they have a variety of choices of Medicaid long-term care. The problem, though, is that when they are entitled under Medicaid to receive it, provided that eligibility determination is done accurately and correctly. The problem is that the area agencies on aging don't control the programmatic budget for those services. So there's a disconnect between the organization or agency that allows entry into the system and paying for the costs of that system. And again, that has some good features to it in with respect to the fact that people should get a fair hearing. And if they're entitled to Medicaid services, then there should be no question about their receiving them. But with respect to the budget, it's hard to control a budget if someone other than the state who has to be accountable for the budget is making eligibility determinations. So the key to it, there may be several solutions to that problem. This is an organizational structure that is in statute, so it is not easily changed, but there are some good, probably managerial ways, not the least of which is a good program monitoring effort, which is what one of the recommendations of that audit was.
Manager. So, John, is all of this saying that, not that you were not clear, but is it saying in layman's language that those people who cannot afford to pay sometimes get in, even though they don't have the money to pay for it, and so therefore the state offset that cost?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that eligibility as far as the senior and persons with physical disabilities waiver is not just based on income. There is an income standard, but there's also an impairment standard. Mm. And that is subject to some judgment. It's not a pure and simple kind of a thing to do. As income, I mean, either person qualifies under their income or they do not. But impairment is a little fuzzier to adjudicate from the standpoint of allowing people into this system.
Further questions for Mr. Britton? Mr. Britton, did you have anything?
No, Madam Chair. Yes. Thank
All
you.
Right. Okay. Then I believe we are ready for the cluster overview from Mr. And would you pronounce your name for me, please?
Pronounced Taves.
Taves.
Doesn't look anything like it's spelled.
Thank you very much. And welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves, the acting assistant director for the cluster on seniors and people with disabilities. And we're very pleased to be here. We have, separate from your budget book, have distributed a separate document, and we tried to take our cues from what Lynn Reed and OMAP did to try to pull out of the budget book and out of the details some of the very high-level issues and talking points that hopefully will inform you about the issues in this cluster and help guide your decision-making in this very difficult budget. And I think Mr. Britton has summarized many of the issues that confront us in the senior and disability system. To provide just a real broad overview of how we propose to proceed over the next series of days, today we want to give you just a very big overview of the cluster itself, how it's structured, the people that we serve, a brief summary of the types of programs and services that we provide. And I'm looking on the book now on pages, starting with page 3. On page 4, starting on day 2, we would like to do a pretty thorough review of the Medicaid program. As Mr. Britton indicated, much of the services for seniors and people with disabilities is funded through the long-term care Medicaid program in partnership with the federal government. And that will get into both the kinds of services that are funded under Medicaid, the eligibility standards. We'll give an overview of Oregon Project Independence, which has been the long-standing state program to provide assistance to seniors and people with disabilities attempting to stay in their own homes. We'll describe what's happening with reimbursements to providers. There are some significant reductions in provider rates that are included in the governor's balanced budget. On day 3, we propose to walk through the direct financial supports that we provide in this cluster, the Older Americans Act, which is largely federal dollars, and then the broad regulatory functions that that this cluster also operates in partnership, again, with the federal government. On day 4, skipping to page 6, we'll go through direct program support, the central administration, and then try to come back to some of the major issues that have been raised and that you undoubtedly will raise as this presentation progresses. And then on day 5, public testimony, and then we'll be back on day 6 to wrap up. On page 9, Madam Chair.
Mr. Taves, if you could hold on just for a moment. Mr. Britton?
Just a point of clarification, Madam Chair and members, that day 5 is now Tuesday, April 22nd, next Tuesday, a week from today.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thanks. Madam Chair, beginning on page 9, we've tried to outline what we would like to really cover in quite a bit of detail as we progress through this presentation. We'd like to give you the best understanding we can of how long-term care has evolved in Oregon, because I think that's very important in terms of addressing what changes have to occur in the future, both with the budget dilemma we face and with the huge upturn in the aging population and the baby boomers. We'd like to compare Oregon to some national trends so you have a sense of where we fare nationally in operating this program. We'd like to give some perspective on the different budget reduction scenarios that we've been back and forth on. This cluster really struggled with how to frame the budget reductions, looking at income, survival priority levels, and a variety of different mechanisms. And it was a difficult exercise for us and a very difficult exercise for the legislature as well. And we'd like to give some perspective on those different reduction scenarios and how they have evolved. And finally, we'd really like to give some perspective both to the risks to the people that use our services and benefit from our services, and the whole structure, again, with the issues of how the budget looks in the next biennium compared to the population demographics. Starting on page 10, Oregon's long-term care policy was fashioned primarily in 1981. It's certainly been added to much through the intervening years, but 1981 was quite an extraordinary year in long-term care in Oregon. The legislature in 1981 passed sweeping legislation on both the senior and the physical disability side, and also on the developmental disability side. ORS chapters 410 and 427 that year were completely rewritten through a very extensive nonpartisan process that involved a lot of consumers, service providers, and families. It really was a rich session of lots of debates about what long-term care should look like. Out of that session, the senior services division was first formed, with disabilities added to it later. But already in 1981, the clear values in long-term care were established by law, and that was that we would always consider the dignity and the independence and the choices of our service consumers, and you'll see that throughout all of the statutes. Those values are reflected over and over again. The values additionally were that Oregon would create its social services policy and its spending practices would conform to create a very, very broad array of community services so that people could stay in their own homes, they could stay with relatives, they could stay in their home communities, and finally that institutional care would be avoided whenever possible, and that every effort should be made to keep people out of institutional care, but at such time when institutional services of some sort are required, that they should be high-quality services. In addition, the statutes that govern all of our services also are rich with lots of directives and statements about consumer and advocacy and family involvement. We have in law a variety of state commissions and councils, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, the Oregon Disability Commission, under federal law, the Developmental Disabilities Council, and in every section of policy making under our statutes, we are continuously directed to always seek the advice and the counsel of these different consumer and advocacy and statutory councils before we make major policy decisions. And we try whenever we can, I should say we always try to be in partnership with our consumer community as we discuss often difficult policy decisions. Moving to page 12, Oregon, along with the kind of watershed changes in statutes in 1981, was also the first state that submitted the home and community-based waiver application to the federal government. And this is the vehicle through which much of Medicaid funds long-term care in Oregon. 1981, under the Reagan administration, began to allow states to use federal Medicaid dollars that historically had been restricted only to state institutions, to nursing homes, and other congregate care facilities. Starting in 81, states were allowed to submit plans on how the same kinds of Medicaid dollars could be used to fund people living in their own homes or living in their home communities. Congress passed in 1981 an amendment to the Social Security Act that allowed states to submit waivers against what otherwise were regulations and funding streams tied to institutions. And Oregon, before the printed bills were barely dry and before the federal government had even printed regulations, Oregon submitted the first waiver, preceding many states by years. And that was the beginning of funding the whole array of services that have certainly matured through the years in people's homes and in their home communities. And really, since 1981, Oregon has continued to be one of the acknowledged national leaders in long-term care policy. Oregon and a handful of other states are always cited as the models when people talk about long-term care around the country. Starting on page 13, is a description of who we serve in Oregon. The cluster of seniors and people with disabilities brought together parts of two former divisions in the Department of Human Services, the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division and what was then known as the Senior and Disabled Services Division. The Developmental Disabilities Program was brought out of the Mental Health Division and combined with long-term care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. So in this cluster, who we serve are seniors and adults with physical disabilities who need assistance in what are called ADLs, activities of daily living, from bathing, dressing, mobility, cognition, eating, elimination, all of the things that a person needs to stay healthy and mobile and independent in their community, or at such time when they can't remain in their own home, then need such supports and assistance in foster care or other kinds of living situations or ultimately in nursing homes or in institutions. Then, starting on page 14, this cluster also serves children and adults with developmental disabilities, as I mentioned. These are primarily intellectual impairments that occur before age 22. There are hundreds of different causes of mental retardation and developmental disabilities, but they almost always result in significant cognitive delays and often are accompanied by a lot of physical problems as well. Sight, hearing, mobility, motor functions are often accompanying disabilities that occur for many reasons, from brain damage at birth to metabolic disorders to environmental factors. There's just a broad range of causes for developmental disabilities. And we serve thousands of people with developmental disabilities who, similarly to seniors, need help with activities with daily living and also need special care and supervision in order to remain in their home communities. And finally, we serve a group of children in the Senior and Disability Services Division as well. In 1996, I believe it was, we transferred the disability program for children from what was then known as the SCF, Services to Children and Families. Historically, children with disabilities were served within the child welfare system, advocates, family members, and a lot of other people felt that disability services for kids ought to be attended to more as a long-term care issue as opposed to a child welfare or a child abuse issue. And so children's services were originally transferred to the developmental disabilities part of the mental health division and then have come to be part of this cluster as well. We serve some very, very fragile children who are very, very dependent in their own homes. We have children on ventilators that have lots of technology needs, that are tube-fed, hydrated, and kids with very, very severe autism, very challenging behavior problems, where we provide a lot of support so they can stay at home with their families and not have to go into alternate kinds of care. Starting on page 16, is a very brief description of where people are served. And again, this is sort of pre the governor's balanced budget or pre the reduction scenarios, but just to give you an overview. On the senior and physical disability side, slightly over half, over 19,000 individuals are served at home. And this is with funded support. So over 19,000 individuals in their own homes get some type of support. It might be chore services, it might be help with cooking, it might be help with taking medications, with mobility assistance, with shopping, with whatever it takes to allow that person to stay in their own home. About 33% or a little over 12,000 are served in substitute community care for individuals who, for whatever reason, cannot remain in their own homes with support. And they're served in a wide variety of community programs, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, foster care. And finally, 16% of those with funded support, 5,677, are served in nursing facilities across the state. On page 17, people with developmental disabilities, again, there's similar patterns. slightly less than half are supported in their own homes, and this is largely a result of the Staley lawsuit settlement, which we'll be speaking at length about in the second and the third days. About 57% of the individuals we serve in developmental disabilities are also in substitute community care, and that includes foster care, group homes, and a variety of residential care facilities. And only 1%, and that's quite a remarkable figure, nationwide, remain in institutional care in Oregon. And that's largely the result of Fairview and many, many years of downsizing state institutions for this population. And then with children with disabilities, again, it shows the percentages of the different kids that we support in different programs at the current time. Madam Chair, moving to page 18, I wanted to just briefly show you that in terms of community care compared to institutional care, Oregon has continued to be way out of the pack, a national leader in this regard on our non-reliance on institutional care models. And when you look all the way back to 1981, despite a 30% increase in Oregon's population, the net decrease in the number of people served in nursing homes has been 33%. So when you talk about that big a population increase and that big a percentage decrease in institutional care, you can clearly see the trends in terms of Oregon's low reliance on institutional care models. On the next page, on page 19, in the developmental disability services area, again, it's the same type of trend. Oregon has one of the lowest rates of institutionalization nationwide, 3 per 100,000 versus a national average of 17. And this is fiscal year 2000 data. A lot of the data that we get from the national groups is several years in arrears, and so this even precedes the final closure of Fairview. So these percentages would even be lower than that. We have on the developmental disability side only one small public institution left in Pendleton with about 50 individuals at Eastern Oregon Training Center. Madam Chair, starting on page 20, just a brief review, and Mr. Britton already described this, but Oregon's long-term care spending patterns. Over 60% of Oregon's long-term care budget is Medicaid, and that's just the federal match portion. That's just the federal dollar that comes in, and then, as Mr. Britton indicated, over 80% of the general fund dollar in this budget goes to match the federal Medicaid dollars. So we are very, very heavily leveraged with federal Medicaid dollars, and much of our business in terms of regulations and service design is all done in partnership with the federal government. Again, most of those Medicaid dollars are used either in institutional care or through several home and community-based waivers. We have a large Medicaid waiver, two large Medicaid waivers, one for developmental disabilities, a separate one for seniors and people with physical disabilities, and then we have a series of smaller waivers, demonstration waivers. We have what are called model waivers that allow support for real high-cost kids in their own homes, some of the medically fragile children we serve under those waivers. I think altogether we have six or seven Medicaid waivers that we operate within this cluster. On page 21, the basic requirement of a waiver of using Medicaid dollars to support someone in a community setting or in their own home is a clear eligibility standard that ties it back to institutional care. So for every individual that we support in their own home or in their home community, we have to document that that person otherwise would be eligible for institutional care and would be at risk of institutional care. And that's one of the primary requirements of the waiver in the application with the federal government. On page 22, again, I think some remarkable statistics. I think Oregon, through many, many years of legislative policy and implementation of that policy, really shows that Oregon's reputation in long-term care is not because we spend the most money. In fact, we're quite a ways down the pack. We're barely average in the overall per capita amount that we spend in long-term care in Oregon. It's really how we spend our dollars as opposed to how much that we spend. For seniors and people with physical disabilities based on national data, we rank 33rd overall, less than average, about 47th in nursing facilities, and that's in part because compared to many parts of the country, we also pay very low rates and serve limited numbers of individuals together, and then we rank 8th for home and community-based care for seniors and people with physical disabilities. On page 23, for spending on people with developmental disabilities, again, you can see the national rankings. And again, this data is always a couple years in arrears, and it's based on the governor's balance on the population served before the governor's balanced budget for the current biennium, where we rank 26th overall, 38th in institutional spending, 16th in community-based care. And again, this would be higher on the community side with the subsequent closure of Fairview. So the point to be made is, again, it's not so much how much we spend historically in Oregon that really gives Oregon a national presence in long-term care, but it's how Oregon has chosen to spend its dollars. On page 24 is just the real high level on the revenue sources. This is based on the governor's balanced budget of slightly more than $2 billion, and again indicates that almost 60% of that is federal dollars. And then on page 25, it shows the split on the expenditures from those fund sources, and those are all program areas that we will cover in considerable detail in the next couple of days.
Mr. Taves, before you go on, would you go back to page 23, please, in that last bullet on the page, which is the statement about Oregon's progressive long-term care system. The statement really goes to, as you said, not how much we spend, but how we spend the dollars that we have. That statement, however, doesn't address the issue of quality. How would you respond? What would you, how would you describe and define the quality of what Oregon offers its citizens who need these services?
Madam Chair, we'll spend a considerable amount of time on how we address the quality of care issues, but I would say, if you talk, in addition to data and licensing and case management and all the other things we do to monitor people's well-being, to investigate abuse and those things, of which we devote a lot of time, that the issue around quality really has been one of choice. And I think when we talk to the people that we serve and the consumers in terms of, are we meeting their choice to remain in their own homes and their own communities? Overwhelmingly, the people that we support say yes. And that really, for them, is first and foremost in terms of quality. Even though at times, choice by different standards, we could say a person living in their own home with support doesn't perhaps meet certain people's standards in terms of cleanliness or how the household is organized or things of that sort. But the primary value in quality and in our statute has been on choice, first of all, with the caveat that if the person is being abused or if certain quality of care standards that are prescriptively defined by the federal government, also defined in state law, if you fall behind that threshold, then we have a legal obligation to investigate, to license, to revoke licenses, and things of that sort. So that's the regulatory side, but from my perspective, the regulatory side only gets you partway to quality. It's sort of the routine things that government has to do to prevent abuse. But beyond that, the question really is, are you responding to what the individual or the family really wants in terms of their own lives?
Thank you. Senator Carter.
On the regulatory side, how often are the homes checked?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, it depends on which program, and again, we'll give you quite a bit of detail on that. We have a lot of different licensing standards for different types of facilities, some that are federally acquired, some that are under state law. I would say, by and large, almost all the homes that we license are checked at least once every 1 or 2 years. In some statutes, it's a 2-year requirement. In some, it's a 1-year requirement. And then, depending on the type of program and the type of previous licensing review, in some programs, we go in and we check multiple times if it's a program that's had particular problems. In addition to that, in different parts of our system, we do a lot of case management reviews. So case managers are out in people's homes or in licensed facilities and doing checks as well. So I think it's a variety of checks and balances, both through the formal licensing side, the case management visits, and then certainly the mandatory reporting of abuse and investigation of abuses. But going back to your question, for most licensed programs, it's at least once a year. For some programs, twice a year.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, moving to page 26, just a very brief overview of Oregon's long-term care structure.
Did you review 25?
Madam Chair, just very briefly, that's the chart of the expenditures, and again, we're going to go through each of those program areas in detail over the next couple of days, but that's how the expenditures are divided up. And again, this is in the governor's balanced budget. Oregon's long-term care structure, Madam Chair, starting on page 26, moving to page 27. This is just an oversight of the senior and people with disabilities cluster. Again, it was formed out of two former divisions where we took those different programs and combined it into four different offices: licensing and quality of care, planning and program development, home and community supports, Office of Employment and Financial Benefits, and each of the administrators of those offices will be presenting more detail about the programs as we go through. I should say, in terms of, and we'll have a later discussion about positions as well, you'll see in the drop-down boxes we have a lot of functions and positions that are associated with this cluster that aren't technically part of our central office, but they're certainly part of our central structure. We do reviews for the Social Security Administration, eligibility for SSI and Social Security. In this program, we still operate one institution in Pendleton. We have a network of state-operated community group homes with state employees that are employees as part of this cluster. We maintain a series of offices with state employees that fill in where counties or councils on government don't operate the local senior and disability services program, and those staff are represented here in this office. And then we have the client care monitoring unit, which is staff that are in federally mandated regulatory programs looking at nursing homes programs primarily. Then also in the boxes above within the central office, we probably have another 70 or 80 positions that are close to client care or client contact positions that still happen to be in the central office. We have case managers for children living in their own homes. We have case managers for children living in out-of-home group home care that are not outstationed in the counties, and a variety of other crisis and assistance positions.
If you could hold at that point, and Mr. Britton would like to make a clarification.
Just a point of clarification, James. The state offices for seniors and for disabled persons, the FT, are not in this budget. Is that right? They're in the community human services budget. Just want to make sure that we're okay on that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Britton, some of them are, some of them are not.
Okay.
In those offices with state employees where the local AAA has elected not to provide either the senior or the disability program, it is true those programs are in community human services. However, we have another category of programs that also are state employees where under statute the county or the AAA elects to supervise that program. And since it's part of our AAA structure, those positions you'll see in the second box over, there's 246 positions listed in contract AAAs, and those are reflected within this cluster. So it's kind of split. State employees are split in two different places.
Is that helpful, Mr. Gray?
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Madam Chair, starting on page 28, over 90% of long-term care services are operated or coordinated through local government. So again, we do not operate a large direct field system with state employees. Almost everything we do is with either counties or council on governments, and then the field offices of the department directly simply fill in the few areas where counties or councils on government have not elected to operate or contract those services. Moving to page 29, for seniors and adults with physical disabilities, in those counties or councils on governments where those services are operated, they are designated under federal law as area agencies on aging, AAAs, and you'll hear a lot about that over the next couple of days. The structure of AAAs in Oregon is quite unique nationally. In most states, or in many states, AAAs just operate the Older Americans Act program. In Oregon, again, sort of based on the sweeping legislation from 1981, we designated AAAs also for the Older Americans Act, but then also clearly allowed AAAs and local governments to take over the Medicaid program from the state. And since 1981, again, much of that workload has been absorbed by counties or councils that are operating as AAAs. On page 30, also unique is that the AAAs that operate the Medicaid programs also do a lot of the eligibility for other benefits, health benefits, signing up, applying for the health care, for the Oregon Health Plan, food stamps, and other benefits. When a senior or person with a physical disability comes to one of our local offices, they really can sign up and get enrolled for services they need across the board. They don't have to go to a variety of different offices to have that happen. And then in a few cases, we have direct contracts with for developmental disabilities. I'm still on page 30. We have a slightly different structure that's, again, in statute, where we contract virtually all of our services through county mental health programs. That still came out of the old mental health and developmental disability structure. Those statutes are still intact. In most places, the county directly operates that program, or in a few places, the county commissioners designate nonprofit agencies. And finally, on page 31, we have lots of other than sub-relationships with transportation. In some cases, AAAs also operate transportation, and a lot of other relationships with other local organizations and providers, which you obviously need to put a full package of supports together to allow people to stay in their home communities. And finally, we have either contracted through local government or directly, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of contracts with community providers. So we have nearly 20,000 in-home workers in the home care program that support individuals in their own homes, and we have hundreds of community nonprofit providers or proprietary organizations that operate group homes and nursing care and ALFs and residential care and facilities. So we have a very vast network that really undergirds the whole community system supporting people in either alternate care or in their own homes.
Mr. Tate, I am going to suggest to the committee that we stop at this point so that we don't rush through the budget reduction choices and issues, and that we take that be our starting point.
Okay.
Tomorrow. And Mr. Naughton, we'll hear from you tomorrow as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 5030. and we are adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you.
So you want me to